thank you very much for that introduction. And you will get to see the picture of erotic magic at work. But don't get your hopes up. This is Muscovy. All right. Well, I've changed my title a little from what was advertised. I think this is more in line with what I want to talk about today. Early modern Russia, or Muscovy, poses difficult, some would even say intractable problems for any historian interested in deciphering the meanings and understandings of the spiritual and the supernatural. Muscovites were generally illiterate, or barely literate, and even those who devoted their lives to theology and the world of letters were generally remarkably theory-averse. So they really did not like to put down on paper systematic generalizations about the way they saw the world. Do you agree? So for the last 20 years or so, those of us in the field have been combing through sources, scraping the walls, trying to find what Muscovite historian at Harvard, Edward Keenan, describes as the candid, confidential, confessional vernacular text that would open for us the real world of these people on the threshold of modernity. This does prove to be an elusive quarry. Not surprisingly, we do have some sources representing the views of elites. So members of the Orthodox leadership of the Orthodox Church and close members of the Tsarist regime wrote down and recorded in imagery some ideas about their ideas of the sacred and the supernatural. But pushing out beyond those elite circles can be very challenging. Fortunately for us, in the context of this series, in their uses and depictions of space, in their maps, both literal and figurative, Muscovites showed a lot about their relations with the transcendent and the supernatural. And they demonstrated their understandings of their interactions with and their effects on the world. Now, maps, of course, can be conceptual or literal mappings of the world. In either case, maps, by definition, have to be schematic and general. They have to concentrate on showing what matters and on omitting what doesn't. In other words, they get their efficacy as an act of simplification and analogy. This is a map of the Amur River. We were just talking about the Amur River Basin at lunch. So this is a map of the Amur River Basin drawn sometime toward the end of the 17th, beginning of the 18th century. It wouldn't be mistaken for the Amur River Basin, of course. This is an analogy, but it's one that has effects in the real world. So if you use this map, you can more or less find your route in functional ways from city A to city B. In other words, the metaphor is showing. There's no attempt to elide the "this is like the Amur Basin," but on the other hand, it acts in an unmediated way in reality if you're moving from place to place. As it happens, this same kind of analogic reasoning also provides the functional efficacy for magic. Muscovite magic rests very much on the power, explicit power, of metaphor. As this, so that. So, as bees swarm to honey, so may the customers swarm to my wares. One of my favorites. As a man loves looking at himself in a mirror, so may my husband love looking at me. As a dead man doesn't need to drink, so may I not need to drink. Or one that I just discovered on the plane coming here. This is a modern one, actually, a 19th century one. The others are all 17th century. A woman was accused of taking three cockroaches and placing them under the head of a corpse and saying, As this dead guy doesn't stand up and walk around, so may these cockroaches not come back to my apartment. This is the standard format for Muscovite magical spells. Magical ingredients also worked by power of analogy. So, in a healing charm to stop the flow of blood, a root that dripped red sap would be used. Or to stop heart pain, a flower that looked like a heart would be used. Like maps, then, Muscovite charms, Muscovite magic, derive their power from metaphor, but work their effects through literalizing that metaphor in the real world, effacing the as and aligning the image with the outcome. So magic is simultaneously metaphorical and perfectly and absolutely literal. So today, what I'd like to do is play with these ideas of maps and metaphor and look at the ways that Muscovites embedded ideas about the sacred in both its religious and magical the supernatural in both its religious and magical senses in their understandings of space and their place in the world. The talk has three unequal parts, one on sacred space, one on how elite, the next one, how elite ideas about sacred space percolated out to a broader public, and then a focus on magic and the intimate sphere of magical space. In conclusion, I want to circle back and think about how all these three demonstrate something important about how Muscovites map their place in the world. Well, political elites in Muscovy were masters at sacralizing space and using space as a way to communicate both with the public and with God. This image, which actually is on the cover of the book that Dan showed, has been much discussed in the literature, and I'm drawing here on the work of other scholars, but hopefully embedding it in a new frame. This is a very important political icon painted in around 1555 to commemorate Ivan the Terrible's conquest of Kazan. Kazan was an independent khanate, one of the remnant states left over after the collapse of the Golden Horde. It was a Muslim independent polity, and the Muscovites beat it, destroyed it in 1552. So this commemorates, quite in a literal sense, Ivan's triumphant march back from the city in flames on the right, and to a city in a kind of heavenly mandala, saintly mandala on the left. Sorry, I'm getting confused by the screen in front of me. But the title signals to us that this isn't just a historical painting about Ivan's conquest of Kazan. It's got more times and meanings embedded in it. This is a message about the heavenly host, the hosts of the armies of God that will fight at the end times. I'm going to move in to show you a detail, but first let me remark that you'll see that there are three lines of soldiers, mounted soldiers, marching back from Kazan, which also denotes Sodom and Gomorrah from the historical biblical past, another set of cities that fell in flames, and presages the cities that will fall in fire and rivers of blood at Armageddon. Okay, I'm gonna focus in on this and show you a close-up. The troops are led by a recognizable figure of Tsar Ivan the Terrible, Ivan the Fourth, and he's surrounded by closely packed regiments of soldiers. The troops leaving the city in flame break into this three-part division, and you may be able to make out on the screen that there's a difference between the middle ranks and the top and bottom ranks. And that is, those on top and bottom are bearing nimbuses. They're saints, they're the holy dead, the martyrs fallen in this godly battle, whereas the ones in the middle presumably are the survivors coming back to Moscow, across the land of Russia, and ending up in this beautiful Edenic site, the heavenly city, the New Jerusalem, which we can recognize both by its mandala, which sets it apart from the secular landscape, and by the three gates, which presumably, if it's a cube, would make the 12 gates of the New Jerusalem. This is an image that's very popular in Russian theological thinking at this time and comes from the book of Revelations. I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, made ready like a bride adorned for her husband. So there you have the Mother of God with Jesus on her lap, handing out martyrs' crowns, which are being flown out by the angels to the martyrs in the top and bottom register. One thing that's strikingly interesting in this image is that the holy circle is cracked open. The trees of paradise, both Eden and paradise to come, are spilling out onto the land, which is marked then as earthly terrain. The troops coming back mark it as specifically Russian earthly terrain. Paradise then is spilling onto the earth here and now. Russians had this amazingly confident eschatological view that they were heading to salvation. They were chosen, they were led by a pious czar, and collectively as a whole, they were marching to salvation. In fact, salvation was already here. Not in any blasphemous sense, they just asserted, we are New Jerusalem. Now, the metaphor is showing a little bit, and you can't see it, unfortunately, in this picture. But there's a difference between the trees of paradise and the trees of the Russian soil. And that is, the ones in paradise have little red fruits. So they just don't show up for some reason. But they're marking the metaphor and literalizing it at the same time. Okay, another efficient way of looking at the same kind of message, the three-part time and the literalizing of metaphor in sacred space, is seen in this image of the Palm Sunday ritual, which was enacted in Red Square every Holy Week from the mid-16th century to the end of the 17th century, when it was abolished by Peter the Great. So the first thing that you see in this very busy image is that there are a lot of people here. The entire vast expanse of Red Square, which if you've ever been there, you know, is a huge open space, is jammed full of subjects of the Tsar kowtowing, groveling on their hands and knees before this procession. They're not just spectators to the parade. They're also participants. They're taking part in this theatrical reenactment of Christ's entry into Jerusalem, playing the role at once of Muscovite subjects and citizens of Jerusalem welcoming their Lord. Okay, so the procession begins coming out of the Kremlin walls, which you see in the background, coming out through the Savior Gates, not coincidentally named, walking through these crowds of subjects, and then I'm going to give you a close-up of this middle scene. The procession was led here by the patriarch, playing the role of Jesus, riding a horse, playing the role of Jesus' ass, the donkey that he rode into Jerusalem. They literally took a horse and stuck donkey ears on it.
Oh.
fake ones. Oh. No, they didn't go chop donkey ears off, but yeah, a donkey costume. So there, I think what they're doing is marking the metaphor. This is not actually Jesus' donkey, in case you were confused. This is a horse playing the role of Jesus' donkey. The patriarch's being led, the reins are being held by the czar, who is walking humbly, barefooted and bareheaded beside the patriarch. There's another stage prop here, harder to make out. This is an artificial tree, which is trundled out on some kind of wagon and evokes the image from the familiar icon, Christ's entry into Jerusalem, and from the biblical texts that say that little boys dressed in white stood in trees singing hosannas and waving palm fronds. Palm fronds are a little hard to come by in Russia, so they're actually waving willow branches in the Russian equivalent. And down at the bottom, we see more boys strewing garments in the path of the Lord. And when we go back to the etching, you'll see that as well. I should note, this icon would have been immediately familiar to every Russian Orthodox subject of the Tsar. By the 16th century, by the late 15th century, the iconostasis, the wall of icons that separates the altar from the main part of the church, was a fixture of every church, and each one had a holiday row that basically had the Stations of the Cross icons. So this would have been visible, familiar, recognizable to everyone in Red Square who saw that ceremony. They would get it. Okay, the goal of this procession is this raised horseshoe-shaped dais, which still sits on Red Square. It's called Lobnaya Miesta, or the place of the skull, Golgotha, which sits, of course, outside of Jerusalem. You can see the patriarch blessing the Tsar at the bottom there. Jerusalem is invoked by this church with its cluster of domes and peaks and entryways and porticos. We think of this, we Westerners tend to think of this as the typical Russian church, but it's not. This is it, St. Basil's. It's kind of a freak construction. It's a one of a kind that was deliberately built to summon up the vision of an entire city massed together. We call it St. Basil's. They called it St. Basil's. Formerly, it was known as the Church of the Intercession of the Mother of God on the Moat. And in popular parlance, it was often called New Jerusalem, in honor of the forwardmost of its eight separate chapels. So now we're moving from an icon that hung in a cathedral in the Kremlin that only the very elite would see, to a ceremony that's involving all of Moscow crammed into the square, taking part in a ritual that says, we are reenacting Christ's entry into Jerusalem. We are celebrating the Orthodox rule of the Tsar. We are anticipating salvation at the second coming. And also, at least for the moment, transforming the brick and mortar city, into New Jerusalem itself. One more quick example of the sacred, which we need as a transition. This is the lowest register, the lowest tier of an important and famous icon called Watering the Tree of the Russian State. It's a very political message in this icon. Again, we see the familiar and identifiable red brick walls of the Kremlin. On either side stand the reigning Tsar, Alexei Mikhailovich. This, incidentally, was painted in 1668, so just 6 years after the last image was done. So Alexei Mikhailovich, probably the first portrait done from life in Russia. And his wife and sons on the other side, holding petitions of supplication directed to Mary, Mother of God, asking her to intercede on their behalf with her son on high to bring blessing on the Russian land. Behind the wall stands the Uspensky Sabor, the main dynastic cathedral, the one where that big icon we started with would have hung. And in front, watering this tree, our two dynastic saints, the first metropolitan and the first grand prince of Moscow. But if we pan up to see the whole icon, we see that the tree of the Russian state is a very crowded place. It's a public place, a collective place, where this whole host of holy ancestors and church leaders and saints are all joining in the chorus of supplication. Each one has a petition directed to Mary, imploring her to win the blessings of her son in heaven on the Russian land, very concretely located in Moscow, in the Kremlin. And if we look at the very top, we find that she has been successful, and Jesus is sending his blessings down through his angels. Okay, so these are some of the consistent messages plotted very spatially about the simultaneity of typological time and the blessed state of the Russian land and the Russian people. But then we hit that question I started with. Was anybody listening? Did anyone get it? Did anyone pay attention? I think we can say they were. At least some people were, and were appropriating these images and ideas actively into their own vocabularies of space and salvation. So this is a page from my personal favorite Muscovite, Semyon Remizov. He's the main character of my last book on history of cartography in Russia, in Muscovy. Remizov is an interesting character. He was born and bred and lived his entire life in Tobolsk, that great booming metropolitan center, which was the capital of Western Siberia. So this is a guy way out from Moscow. You can't very well get more out in the sticks than this. He did go to Moscow for 3 months in the 1680s and presumably saw the watering the tree of the Russian state icon. But when he got back home, he put it to work. So this is his tree of Tobolsk. The foliage, now not filled with saints and princes, is filled with the names and dates of the governors of Tobolsk. So this is kind of a bureaucratic take on a great salvation narrative. He's reproduced the tiers of supplication and intercession. So here, the lowest level, you've got a bunch of Cossacks, Yermak, the guy who conquered Siberia, interceding for the mercy of Ivan the Terrible, the guy in the middle on the throne, who's interceding for mercy with the Mother of God, who's interceding with her son in heaven. And Jesus is literally pouring his blessings down on the Siberian land. You can see showers of golden rain and fruit coming down from on high. Onto this, again, spatially rooted, grounded tree of Siberia. And the appropriations of this imagery get even more startlingly secular and bureaucratic. So this image on the left is a map. It's not just a map, it's a real estate litigation map. It's produced by low-level clerks, again, out in the countryside, out in the provinces. This is a case that pitted the town of Uglich in the middle against the Ulitsky Monastery up in the corner. Really ugly case with theft and lying and beating each other's peasants up. Hideous, litigious production. And yet, this is the way they map the land in a document that they're going to hand in to the judges and say, this plot and this plot actually belong to us, not to them. They're carving properties out of the verdant foliage of the Russian forest. They're signaling that, like a sacred mandala, this space is different. It's somehow different from the surrounding terrain, elevated by the fact of ownership. And incidentally, it's our ownership. Seems to me that a lot of their way of envisioning the world is coming out of the iconographic and theological vision that they're receiving from on high and is informing their prosaic view of the world. Here again, little plots. These are more sort of eccentric peanut-shaped mandalas, but still little plots of land claiming possession in the vast, undifferentiated forest. So, what about magic? Well, for magic, we leave the grand, public, collective spaces of the polity and Christian salvation, and we move into the most private, enclosed, hidden recesses of intimate life. Most magic seems to take place within the home. We know where people considered the most effective sites of magic from surviving spell books. There are quite a lot of spells that survive, and they often have their own stage directions. Get up, put this in the threshold. Get up without crossing yourself. Exit through the window and not the door, that kind of thing. But they locate the spaces where magic will most effectively be enacted. And we also have courtroom testimony from witchcraft and magic trials, where accusers and confessors coincide in identifying the most private and hidden of spaces as particularly those targeted by magic. Accusations arise when people find bunches of roots or clusters of strange grasses tied in mysterious knots, or clods of dirt, or dust that has been swept out of footprints. They find these tucked under the threshold, in the stove, or in the recessed sleeping quarters. This is a horrible 20th century painting, but I think it conveys a sense of what the interior space of these houses would be like. You know, the youngest son in a fairy tale is always sleeping on the stove, and my students always get really alarmed that somehow they're sleeping on the gas stove. But actually, it's in this curtained space above the stove. It's a warm, private, recessed spot, the prime sleeping spot. Witnesses find dead mice, loathsome creatures, and the pervasive roots and grasses tucked into the rafters above the sleeping quarters, into the platform, into the mattress, and so forth. Of course, the spaces of the house, the intimate spaces of the home, aren't the only places that get targeted. The person of the target also gets targeted. So the clothing is a target for magic. A serf woman confessed to stealing her mistress's headdress, much like the one on the left here, and putting it under a heavy post and saying, "As this post is heavy, so may it be heavy for my mistress." Or stealing her mistress's blouse and cutting a swatch of fabric over the place where it would rest over her heart, burning that fabric and saying, "As this fabric burns, so may my mistress's heart burn and wither." Of course, then the surface of the body isn't the limit. Magic needs to get inside, to penetrate even deeper into the dark interiority of the body. And here in this image, which, as far as I know, is the only image of magic at work from the entire Muscovite period, we have a love spell at work. This is my erotic image. You may not think so, especially if you've seen German images of witches from the same period. This may be a bit of a letdown. But for various reasons, not least of which is her unkempt hair. This is clearly an erotic encounter, a magical and bewitched erotic encounter. The two of them are toasting with little cups that you can see at the fold, if you look hard, presumably drinking the enchanted brew that's in the bottle that the woman is holding in her right hand. We're lucky to know the kind of spell that would have accompanied this, because the sketch is preserved in a spell book that was turned in as evidence in a witchcraft trial that actually began as a rape trial. It's a hideous case. This is the kind of text that accompanies that image, just so you can see what it looks like. The predominant theme of the spells collected in this book are love spells or sex spells, but passionate ones. And they tell us that not only the potions that people would drink, but the words accompanying them targeted the insides of the body. So let me read one of these spells to you. Go back to our image. Oh, a couple preliminary remarks. Spells tend to be addressed to slave so-and-so. The so-and-so is because these are fill-in-the-blank spells. Your love object du jour can just be slotted in. Slave comes from the phrase slave of God, so it's not actually a sociological descriptor, although this is a slave-owning society, but they drop of God in spells, usually. Okay. This spell is also unusual because it mentions Satan, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. O you Satan, with devils, with little ones and great ones, fly out from the ocean sea. Take my fiery tuska. Tuska means woe or misery or longing. Go around the white world. Do not set fire to stump or log or moist tree, nor earth nor grass, but set fire to the soul of that slave for me. As that fire burns, so may that female slave burn for me, for this slave, white body, ardent heart, black liver, impetuous head with brains, with clear eyes, with black brows, with sugary lips, as miserable, as bitter as a fish without water, just so may the female slave so-and-so be miserable, bitter for me. So in these spells, the fantastic and the real, the literal and the figurative, the emotional and the physical all become so marvelously intertwined as to lose distinction, or rather to work their magic by their mutual interpenetration. Magic sits in multiple locations, from folkloric islands and seas to humble sleeping platforms and moving ever closer to the clothing that rests on the flesh or within that flesh, to the ardent heart, black liver, and 77 veins. So at this point, this survey may foster the impression that sacred space and magical space have nothing in common, that they're not opposite ends of a single pole like the divine and the satanic. Rather, they're just from altogether different conversations. And to be honest, this distinction makes a lot of sense in the context of Russian witchcraft. I mentioned that Satan is really unusual. Russian witchcraft avoids the kind of implication in a grander religious narrative that characterizes the discussion of witchcraft in Catholic and Protestant Europe at this time. In the West, of course, the explanation for magic's efficacy tends to be attributed to the devil, and there's a systematic effort to inculcate that view. Nothing of the kind happens in Russia. The concern tends to be secular, and it tends to be concern about the harm worked through maleficium or porcha. It's tried in secular courts, and it's really a concern about harm. So it sort of makes sense that they have different vocabularies of space and so forth. But by examining these two sets of spatial ideas within a single frame, I think we can reach a kind of productive rethinking of the way that space meant in Muscovy. Metaphors clearly had striking potency, a power to bring spiritual forces into contact with the earthly and to transform the mock-up into reality. Palm Sunday made Moscow a duplicate and a model and an imitation and a foreshadowing of the heavenly city, but it also transformed the city into the thing itself. Woe moved metaphorically, but also literally into the body of the love object, leaving her literally gasping for breath. Now, several of the scholars who've worked on these elaborate church rituals and fresco cycles and all have admitted that some of their details are so arcane that ordinary folk never would have understood them. And so when pressed on what's the point then, if no one gets it, they tend to say, well, orthodoxy is about performing for God, doing things according to Hoyle, the way you're supposed to, and then it's done, and God is happy. Audience of one. I think this survey suggests that there's more to it than that, and that we can critique that view on two counts. First, the core messages, if not all the refinements, the core messages do seem to have been understood more broadly and taken up and appropriated by all sorts of people throughout the society. And secondly, and more pointedly for this talk, the movement and manipulation and mapping of space was understood to work real effects, both in the immediacy of the house and home, in the more communal context of court and church, and in the cosmic context of eternal salvation. These people weren't performing for an audience of one. They were busy creating new and better realities. I just, in closing, thought I would come to the Borges story, which may have been mentioned already in this series. It's the most hackneyed starting point for history of cartography talks. There's this famous Borges story of the emperor who declares that his empire needs to be mapped on a one-to-one scale and produces a map that covers the entire empire. Well, I think the Muscovites do it the other way around. What they do is they map the supernatural into or onto quotidian space, whether public or hidden, collective or individualized. And they conjure that life-size model into being. Self-consciously enacted through visible metaphor, Muscovite rituals, whether orthodox theology, secular litigation, or magical spells, created the realities that they performed. Thanks. So I guess we have a few minutes for questions.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
One immediate question. The tree of the Russian state, if you had an image like that in the West with the tree of Jesse, is there a relationship between those two?
You know, I'm interested in that question. And you may know more about this. I've been looking for trees of Jesse, and there is one in the what's it called? The Royal Cathedral, in the third cathedral in the Kremlin. Rozhdestvensky?
Oh, wow.
Blagoveshchensky. Yeah,
Annunciation.
Annunciation. So there's a big tree of Jesse in the fresco cycle on the ceiling of the entry hall. I haven't found a lot more of them, and I don't know when they start being painted. So I just thought of that this summer, and when I saw that one, realized I have to research that. I don't know. Do you know?
There's an icon of the Tree of Jesse.
There's what?
I think there's an icon of the Tree of Jesse, but it's not a very common one. It's
certainly not common, yeah.
And it may be newer.
Right, right. Yeah, and the frescoes in the hallway there, I think are 18th century. They're certainly late 17th century. Yes?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for that nice talk. That tree actually reminded me more of the Tree of Life from Kabbalistic tradition. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that there was 20 of the mandalas on those trees, double the number of the tree that of the life, the tree of life, or the Sephiroth, I think it's called, and the tree of life. And that just reminds me of the way that Christianity, you know, in my opinion, would show itself as a further development or an evolution of Jewish theology.
Very interesting.
Yeah, there are some flickerings of familiarity with Kabbalistic traditions that come kind of in really flickering moments in this early modern period. I don't know if there would be a direct link, but certainly that shared origin is apparent everywhere. The drawing on the Old Testament is a standard trope.
Yeah, interesting.
Your tree of Tobolsk had a blank leaf. So is he conducting it as a chronicle?
Yeah, I think he is.
For the next governor?
I think that's right. Yeah. I haven't gone back to look at the date on the one before, but my impression is that it was an ongoing process.
Are they just names? I couldn't, the print was small enough. The cursive is, needs more time, right?
Right. Yeah, they're names and dates. Yeah. Yes?
I just had two questions. The first one was, would you consider one of the main reasons for the low rate of prosecution of witchcraft in Russia due to two factors, one being that demonology really hadn't penetrated Russia like it had in the West, and also the prevalence of paganism among the peasantry as being another reason why perhaps it was less reported or less of a problematic among the peasantry. And the second short question is, I come across this term poshika quite a bit in the literature, and I was curious as to whether there was a consensus on the actual definition of poshika or whether it's just the Russian word for malefikia, if you can elaborate on that at all.
Poshika.
Poshika being a type of bocha.
Uh-huh.
I came across a couple of definitions. One, Zalesniak defines it as being either a sort of borcha, regular, you know, spoilage of whatever crops and livestock. And the second definition would be, according to Zalesniak, a definition that, it's a vulgar sort of, it's another word for intercourse, basically, or unsanctioned intercourse. So I don't know. I've just been very ambiguous with that term myself.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't show up in my sources. And if it's mainly about agricultural magic, that would make sense, because agricultural magic was not prosecuted in court ever. I have one case that involves horses, but that's involving Lithuanian magicians. So I'm sure it's not that there wasn't agricultural magic, but for some reason it did not rise to the level of something that would be prosecuted. So that term doesn't show up. There's lots of sexual magic, but they don't use that term. So maybe it's a later term. So I can't enlighten you on that except to say it comes in later. On the low rates of prosecution, I actually have pretty strong feelings on this paganism business. If you asked a peasant by the 17th century, which is when these trials happen, whether they were Christian, they would say yes. I mean, you ask them who they were, they would say they were Orthodox before all. Sure, they had traditions that had continued from pagan times, but they didn't see them as worshiping pagan gods. They saw them as just what you do on Thursday or whatever it is. And so I'm very skeptical of that whole Dvayavirya dual belief idea. I don't think they're any more pagan than anybody else who retains earlier traditions. They are less concerned with enforcing conformity. And they, after all, they have their first real heresy, church schism, in the 17th century. They're really slow getting around to the idea that it's their business to patrol and police. And they can't, really. So some of it, I think, is that the church just doesn't set that as a goal. But also, magic is absolutely endemic in the society. Everybody from the czar to the lowest slave practices it, fears it, hires witches to do stuff. So it has to rise to a certain level of criminality before it gets attention. So I think that's how I would answer that one. Yes?
Well, I'm just going to remark on the fact that so much within Orthodoxy is a renewal of a blessing, making potential impure pure. So that those places that are not blessed or that are not renewed, the blessing is not renewed, including homes, are potentially places where something not so good can occur, including potentially magic. So it's just interesting that since in the culture, things are either of God or not of God, whether or not you actually refer to Satan or something, there's almost a kind of implication. What is interesting is that there's this middle ground which this magic seems to describe. That it's not necessarily actually evil, but it's not actually good. It's a very strange middle ground within the society that is not, it doesn't seem to be found anywhere else other than with, let's say, the Muscovite Church that I know of. So I just find it very interesting, right? And the places where magic can occur or when it can occur is also quite fascinating.
Thanks. There's something you wanted to say on that. Oh, yeah. Magic is labeled ungodly and even demonic in the church texts. But I was saying at lunch, everything that isn't actively godly is. So it's in there with swinging on swings and singing songs and coming drunk to services on Sunday. So it's not demonic in the way that Western demonologists imagine witchcraft to be. But that, I think, just reinforces your point that there's not a lot of imagined gray zone. And this is one of those that seems to muddle that picture.
Well, and you also mentioned at lunch that being accused of witchcraft, I mean, this is something very criminal on par with some other very serious crimes. And so it wasn't necessarily something, you know, that just the lower courts would have to deal with, but something that really shows kind of what society thought of it when it reached that level.
Yeah, so certain kinds of witchcraft were considered among the most heinous crimes in the society, along with treason, rebellion, and heresy. But only certain kinds. So if it was magic that led to a death, or magic that involved an assault on the czar, someone close to him, those would be treated with the utmost seriousness. But crimes that made someone a little sick, those kinds really do seem to, this making the impure pure seems to be a lot of the impulse in those trials, that, okay, you've been doing this, stop, okay? And rejoin society, although with certain surveillance. So I think it plays on both of those levels. Yeah.
Val, thanks for a fascinating lecture. I was really struck by the extent to which you could sort of explore the mental universe of these 16th and 17th century Muscovites, and especially the degree to which you sort of go beyond the elites. I wondered if you could say a little more about that. Obviously, the vast majority of the population is not even going to set anything down on paper and not going to make a map at all. But it seems like, you know, the implications of your research are that this does actually does encompass the entire society. Would that be safe to say?
Yeah, I think it does. And I've gotten barbed criticisms recently for reviving the Slavophile myth, that we have this organic unity and harmony within the society. And I guess in part I am saying there is unity. It's a very shared culture, top to bottom. What I'd get rid of is the harmony, because these cases foreground hideous abuse, hierarchically arranged and institutionalized abuse. So it's a unified culture with inequity fiercely built into it. Yes.
I have a couple of questions. One is, do you know the artist of that drawing of the Palm Sunday in Red Square?
It's Meyerberg. Yeah.
And the second is, I was wondering if you could comment on your conclusion where you say that this magic actually did work, and how you mean it.
Yes. I'm very influenced by a book that I read recently called Ethnographic Magic by a man named Harry G. West. It's about contemporary magic in Mozambique. And he starts with this wonderful little anecdote where he goes to Mozambique, he studies the phenomenon of people who are thought to be witches, and they turn into lions at night and kill people. Of course, most of the people are still alive. Yeah, there's certain problems from our kind of rationalist point of view with this analysis. So he stands in front of his Mozambican colleagues and he explains the symbols and the work that symbols do in reintegrating society and all of this stuff. And at the end of one of the Mozambicans raises his hand and he says, "Excuse me, I think you are mistaken. These are lions." So that's the starting point of his study. You know, how can this be? We know that this is not a lion, this is a human being. And he comes to the conclusion that as an ethnographer, what he does is he goes out in the world and he imposes meaning on it. And then it sort of becomes that his interpretations do real work in the world. And in that same way, sort of phenomenologically, the firm belief that these people are lions means that they are lions to all functional purposes. They're not like lions, they are lions. So it's a little maybe metaphysical. I'm not a believer, I have to say, in magic. But I do believe that magic works real effects on the world of people who believe it. So you see roots under your threshold, there are going to be real world consequences. Or you have an illness, you interpret it as magic, that's also going to have real world consequences. So I'm talking about their perception of the world. Is that?
Yes, I understand. It reminds me of Alexei Losev's description of mythical consciousness and the dialectics of men. And it's precisely about this. But it's interesting that it is also your emphasis on the real effects of magic in that society, and where we would speak about the perception of real effects from our point of view. It is also interesting that with regard to this, it's very interesting to look into the dynamics of these very different worldviews clashing, coming together, and how these encounters evolve and what they spell for the future of these worldviews.
The religious and the magical, you mean?
The mythical view of the world on the one hand, and the rationalistic view of the on the other hand, which in many cases has suppressed that mythical substratum.
Yeah. And that's the hardest thing in working on magic, I think. Can I take one more?
I was wondering how Russia, because of its terrain and its weather, the wars that the Western Europeans tried to bring into Russian to Russia didn't work. Is that maybe why the prosecutions didn't become so severe, that the influence of more Western Europe was maybe not as great?
That's tricky, because Western influence is certainly attenuated, I think, more by the religious cultural barrier than the terrain or the weather. But witch trials peak, they don't reach a huge peak, but they peak just around the same time that their neighbors are, just a little later. So there does seem to be some influence that maybe the monarch says, this is what a good monarch does. There's no smoking gun. I can't find that link. But probably there's some connection through Poland and Ukraine that comes up to Moscow. But there's no way to trace it.
Thank you very much for fascinating, magical talk.
Thank you.